Hello, welcome to Farmgate. I'm Finlow Castain, the Chief Executive of Farmwell. The best solutions for land use deliver multiple outcomes, especially in places where land is relatively scarce and expensive. In recent years, opponents of renewable energy, particularly solar electricity with its large glassy arrays, have argued that land should be kept in agricultural production. From the other side, solar developers have argued that arrays are nearly always sited on low-grade land and that biodiversity will benefit from the soil being given a break from intensive monocropping. Well, what if we could do both? What if we could combine the farming of electricity from the sun with land management that regenerates the soil and produces high-quality nutrition? Sophie Fernley-Whittingstall lives in Wiltshire in the UK and provides community engagement and communications advice for the solar industry. Trent Hendricks is from Cabrieho Ranch in Missouri, USA, where he produces lamb and beef with certification from the American Grass-Fed Association and the Alan Savory Land to Market Program. Welcome both. Sophie, let's start with some basics. Solar farms are large industrial installations which constrain land use for up to 40 years. So why is solar on agricultural land a good thing?
Well, Finlow, as you said in your introduction, it's all about multifunctional land use. Our land is under increasing amounts of pressure to deliver lots of different objectives. And a solar farm isn't just about generating clean renewable energy. It can tackle climate change through the energy generation, but it can also support biodiversity and ecological initiatives, and you can keep the land in agricultural use, contributing to the supply of food, for example, with sheep grazing, honey bees making honey, and other food-related initiatives.
So why would a farmer want to have a solar farm on their land in the first place?
In the UK, certainly, it's increasingly difficult for farmers to make a good living from farming, both due to Brexit and the implications of that, and also due to the extreme weather conditions caused by climate change. I think we've all seen evidence of that in Europe. Obviously, a solar farm can help with tackling the climate emergency, but for a farmer, it can also provide a reliable, secure income in terms of rental from the land, which is guaranteed for the life of the solar farm, which nowadays is about 40 years. After 40 years, all the infrastructure for the solar farm can be completely removed, and the land can be returned to its original use, probably in a better condition. Overall, the footprint of the infrastructure takes up only about 1% of the land take used.
1%? So there must be some distance between them if it's only a 1% land impact.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the solar panels are supported on frames that are piled into the ground. There is no concrete used other than for some of the supporting infrastructure such as substations. And then wide gaps are left between the solar panels to allow them to get the maximum amount of sunlight, but also that leaves plenty of space for other farming activities to go on around them.
Do you tend to have lots of cables sort of trailing around the place, or are those buried under the soil?
The cables are all buried underground. There are some cables that are attached to the solar panels. Anything like that is usually elevated so that it's out of the reach of an inquisitive sheep, so that it's quite safe and secure.
Now, Trent, you're a sheep farmer rather than a solar farmer, but you've developed a pretty unique model for rearing livestock regeneratively in and amongst the solar arrays in the USA. How does your system work?
It's an interesting marriage of very old traditional livestock rearing in a relatively modern environment. For example, since the dawn of time, people have been taking their livestock to food, to feed, to grass, and following that, we call it transhumance. And essentially what we're doing today is the same principle, is we are taking our sheep to grass, the difference being that the grass is under solar panels and we haul them there in trucks instead of going in a circuitous pattern up and down mountains and so forth. So we're really, it's just applying age-old stock rearing, land management skill sets in a modern environment.
That's really fascinating. It's the idea that you're recreating something which is essentially a traditional form of agriculture, but then giving it this modern sort of more technical spin on it. And I'm just curious, do you have to pay rent to get those grazing rights from the solar farm owners?
We are paid to manage vegetation on these sites. And so we receive payment for managing the grass. We are given the contracts because we manage them predominantly with livestock, leading to other attributes and outcomes on the land that one would probably not be able to enjoy or participate in with mechanical or chemical solution. So we are providing a service and we are compensated for that.
So in the same way that in the UK, you've got farmers that are earning an income from having the solar farm on their land, you're earning an income by managing, by servicing the solar farms around and about in the USA. And you're quite a big business. You work in many different states, don't you? But you have different operations in different places around the USA.
That is correct. More of a regional footprint. We do work in multiple states, and the movement of the animals is largely relative to the size of the properties. Originally, many of the solar properties were rather small, so those animals may get hauled more frequently, but typically very short hauls, you know, 10 miles, 20 miles up the road. But as the solar industry is maturing, we are now looking at sites that are many thousands of acres, and those sites will have resident flocks where only the production is moved in and out of those sites under normal circumstances.
And as a regenerative shepherd, when I think of regenerative grazing, I'm generally thinking of adaptive multi-paddock grazing, mob grazing, that sort of thing. Even within these larger sites, are you able to use that same principle and constrain the space that the sheep have?
Absolutely. That's a critical component for managing not only the vegetation, but the welfare of the sheep, from a consistent plan of nutrition to managing parasites, etc. We are always moving them to clean ground. And of course, it's highly variable based off of the needs of the animals, the size of the site, quality of the forage. I mean, there's a lot of variables that go in there. So yes, we do use holistic plan grazing. It comes under a lot of different names, but essentially, it's an intentional management plan, moving sheep according to the needs of the sheep, the land, and the forage, and of course, in a solar farm, the needs of the solar farm operators.
So essentially, it's the same as being a regenerative shepherd anywhere else. It's just that you've got this kind of additional constraint. And I wonder, as a regen shepherd, what kind of additional constraints you find on a solar farm that you wouldn't come across in a normal field or ranch?
I think some of the biggest ones is interfacing with more people. The larger the solar site, the more technicians, the more service-oriented people that are in and out of sites, and ensuring simple things like gates being closed and preferably not having solar technicians having to work in and around the sheep just for everybody's convenience factors. So we have another level of scheduling, also working with routine maintenance on a solar farm, making sure that we've grazed ahead of them to ensure that they're working in short grass as much as possible. Most of these solar farms have a very adequate external fence, but we do have predation issues from time to time that need to be managed, much like anywhere else we would graze livestock. The biggest thing is just in a owned or leased pasturage situation, we look at forage and we say we can potentially store that forage, whereas on a solar farm, we have specifications we need to adhere to, and that may mean that we either need to graze more aggressively or potentially mechanically intervene from time to time. So instead of managing the growth of the grass and viewing it solely as food for the sheep, we also have to ensure that it does not shade the site. The number one priority of a solar farm is to collect sunlight for electricity. So we cannot have grasses, forages, etc., limiting that production, and we can't have vegetation interference with mechanical hardware, etc. So there's just a few filters or parameters that we would engage in on a solar farm that we would not have to necessarily deal with in a traditional grazing environment.
When you're talking about the height of the grasses there, I'm thinking, you know, about the rest periods that you tend to associate with regenerative grazing, where you have long rest periods and you can have really quite high grasses. Does that mean that you have shorter rest periods between grazing sessions, perhaps, than you might on a ranch that didn't have the solar installation?
Typically, no. In our spring, when everything is growing very rapidly, that's typically our biggest threat of shading time. If we can manage that first round of growth, we can typically handle it quite well the rest of the season. There are variables there in the type of forages planted in the South, in the Mid-South. In the United States, a lot of warm season perennial type plants, plants that grow by rhizome, they're typically height limited in a natural state anyway, but they also tend to be lower quality feed. So we've found that in order to manage the rapid growth of grass in the spring across thousands of acres, it's difficult to do that. You never have enough sheep in the spring, and it's easy to have too many sheep in the late summer or winter. So that's a balance that we have to manage more closely in a solar situation than we would in a non-solar situation. And sometimes we will mechanically manage grass for two reasons. One, it buys us time to ensure that it doesn't shade, but it also means that when we do bring the sheep in, the feed value of that grass is higher, but we are not typically sacrificing rest time. In fact, I would say that we do a pretty good job of ensuring there is complete rest between grazings. And what we do is we hit the grass typically harder than we might elsewise to make sure that it's set back sufficiently so we can give it the time it needs and have all the species of forage have an equal chance to regrow before we come back again. So, you know, sometimes we do a great job, sometimes not so much. It's nature. You know, we definitely use feedback loops to ensure that we're continuously improving.
And what about the sheep and the technology itself? Do you have sheep sort of leaning on things or chewing things that then get damaged, or vice versa? Do you have sheep that get injured by rubbing up against the corner of something that they shouldn't?
No, we've not seen that to be an issue. It's a frequent question. We've learned that inverter pads are, it's a good idea to put a little fence around them to exclude the sheep from them, because it's in the sheep's nature to fill their belly and then go find a high place to lay down and ruminate. And they like the high ground for a couple of reasons, including looking out for predators and possibly more importantly, enjoying the breeze that they get. And inverter pads on solar sites tend to be some of the higher ground, and they like to lay on them. And when they stand up, they manure, and the cooling fans on the inverters draw air in, and you could potentially foul the inside of that. We've also had one situation where there was an emergency stop button that was at an ideal location for sheep to scratch their backs on, and it shut down a portion of the array. So we've learned it's much simpler just to put a small fence around it and keep the sheep off of it. Other than that, no, not really. Sometimes if there's roads in a site, they like to lay down on the roads for similar reasons, and so that can foul roads up a little bit. Good rain usually takes care of that. Stray dogs, feral dogs, are a bigger issue in more suburban environments. But, you know, you deal with that in a non-solar environment as well. So there's a lot less friction with the sheep and the equipment. The sheep adapt actually quite quickly, and typically we don't see an issue.
So in your business, you're earning money as a shepherd, rearing sheep and selling the sheep. You're also earning money by servicing these solar installations, using the sheep to do that. Now, this is a pretty unique business model, it seems to me, from across in the United Kingdom. Are you unique across in the USA, or are there loads of people doing this?
It is growing very, very rapidly. It's still very much the early days, and that's part of why we enjoy getting an opportunity to speak about what we do to ensure that the industry is growing professionally. There's a lot of small operators, and that's a fantastic thing, but we do want to make sure that as an industry, we begin to identify consistencies in performance and delivery, in the business structures, the costing models, etc. And it is a fantastic opportunity. And, you know, just a small aside on that is part of why we see it as a fantastic opportunity is agriculture is extremely capital intensive, very thin margins, very subjective to environmental impact and market cycles. If a producer can secure a multi-year contract to take care of land for a solar provider, it now has consistency of cash flow. It allows the producer to invest more aggressively into CapEx and capital expenditures. It also provides that cash flow baseline. And we see it as a fantastic opportunity for new producers and young producers and family businesses that want to create opportunity for younger family members to participate. So it really is a fantastic opportunity for agriculture. We have a great desire to do our bit to ensure that it becomes a good, viable industry that we would love to see the vast majority of solar farms managed in this way.
Sophie, I'm really interested in how this experience in the USA can transpose to the UK. Sheep already quite often feature on solar farms around Britain. And I wonder how those relationships between solar developers and farmers come about as it stands, and whether this sort of model that Trent's talking about exists here at all.
Well, yes, sheep have been grazing on solar farms since the early days of the solar industry in the UK, dating back to around 2013, mainly because large-scale solar farms are usually built on agricultural land, And the landowner or landowners, because nowadays solar farms are getting increasingly large, they may already farm sheep. If they don't, they usually know somebody else who does. I'm working on an interesting project at the moment with two landowners. One is an organic sheep farmer, and part of the site will be grazed by sheep all the year round, because that's part of their business model. The other part of the site, we're looking to maximise the ecological and biodiversity benefits a little more. So the sheep grazing will happen in the autumn and the winter, which will allow the wildflowers to get established and set seed in the spring and the summer. So there are a lot of different ways that you can manage a sheep grazing regime on a solar farm here in the UK. And yes, it's something that we're seeing more and more of now.
And are you aware of any solar farms in the UK that have sheep on them using an adaptive multi-paddock approach? For example, using electric fences to constrain the area that the sheep are in, you know, more than the field itself? Or is it that they generally go in and they have the run of the field?
I haven't seen that in the UK. Our land pattern tends to consist of smaller fields, I think, than in the US. So what I do see, and I live very close to a solar farm, which I walk past, you know, 3-4 times a week, and I notice that the farmer moves the sheep from field to field. You know, they will stay in one field for a week or so, and then they'll move into the next field. But I haven't seen the fields subdivided up like that with electric fencing here, but I don't see why it wouldn't work here if it works in the States.
And I wonder, you know, where the incentive comes from, or where the idea comes from to actually have a solar farm in a particular place. Is it farmers that are getting in touch with solar developers, or is it the solar developers getting in touch with the farmers? Is it the farmers developing the solar themselves?
It's a bit of both, really. The number one constraint on where you can put a solar farm is a connection to the electricity grid. Increasingly, as the electrical grid is becoming more constrained here, we're looking for other opportunities as well. So, for example, you might want to put in a solar farm that has a private wire direct connection to a large energy user, say close to an industrial unit or a supermarket or something like that. But the number one constraint is access to the electricity grid.
So if you're just talking about constraints and the grid connection, I mean, how far away does a solar farm need to be from a grid connection, and why is that?
Well, you can build a solar farm up to about 10 kilometres away from a grid connection.
10 kilometres, that's quite a long way, actually.
Yes, you can sometimes connect directly into the grid on site if you've got pylons or overhead electricity lines crossing the site. But also, if grid capacity is constrained, you can look at connecting directly into an energy user as well, which is happening more and more here in the UK, particularly since it's become harder to make the economics of solar work with the withdrawal of subsidies.
You just mentioned subsidies there. And of course, you know, going back sort of 5 years or so, there were a lot of community scale solar farms. And these days, they tend to be much bigger. Why has that change happened? Why aren't there community scale solar farms now?
Yeah, well, we call it the solar coaster in the UK because of the very rapid changes in government policy, which have had a big influence on the size and scale of projects that have been developed. There was no solar development at all between about 2016 and 2019. And now, because of the falling costs of solar, it has become economical without a subsidy, but it means that you have to do the projects at a much larger scale. So you're seeing now developers developing projects of around 50 megawatts, which is still of a scale that can be decided by the local authority rather than by the national government. Now, a 50 megawatt solar farm is probably, you're looking at a capital cost of around £25 million. That puts it out of the reach of most community energy projects or developers. But increasingly, we're seeing developers partner up with community groups to offer shared ownership in their solar farms and community investment in their solar farms so that communities can still get involved with them. But that way, they leave the tricky stuff of raising large amounts of money to the developers and their investors, but the community can still get involved and have a share of the profits going back in to support the local economy by working in partnership with larger developers.
So those larger developments that we're talking about now, they're up to 50 megawatts, as you say. I seem to remember that community solar farms tended to be around sort of 5-ish megawatts. Yeah. Is that right? So they were obviously much smaller. And what kind of land area are we talking about for 50 megawatts?
So for a 50 megawatt solar farm, you need around 200 acres of land. It's got to be relatively level land that can be easily screened from any neighbourhood properties, because people don't like to look at solar farms and they don't like to look at solar panels where they had green fields before. So we make sure that we can put, if there aren't already existing mature hedges and woodland, we make sure that we can plant those to fill up any gaps so that people don't have to look at the panels. They also need to be on areas that don't have any special landscape designations. So it's difficult to build a solar farm in an area of outstanding natural beauty. It may be difficult or more challenging in Greenbelt. And finally, we look for areas of land that are not best and most versatile. So that means a grade 3B or below.
And of course, it's that sort of land that often can benefit the most from a regenerative approach to agriculture, where you're improving the quality of that land and recycling the nutrients, getting it working better than it was before. So from that perspective, it's really interesting to hear, when you've got a large area like that, that ability to stack enterprises becomes really important.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's about using your land to deliver more than one objective. If you have solar panels on the land underneath it managed positively with wildflower meadows to boost biodiversity and ecology, increase the number of pollinators on the land, you're also benefiting from carbon sequestration. But perhaps the biggest benefit is you're no longer pumping lots of chemicals into the land in order to be able to get a crop off it. The land is regenerating itself over time.
Trent, one of the key reasons that you talk to people like me is that you want to demonstrate that regenerative agriculture is a big solution, that regen is possible at scale. Now, I know that you don't want to go into specifics about the size of your business, but are you able to give us some idea of the size of your flock? Because we're really not talking in terms of 200 or 300 ewes, are we?
No, and we do run quite a few ewes, several thousand, but we also purchase many thousands of feeder lambs or stalker lambs from other producers that we take through the green season and then fatten and harvest. So, you know, we're running many, many thousands of lambs as well as thousands of ewes cross. So, you know, we would view it as a commercially viable, statistically viable operation going across many, many thousands of acres. And really the pipeline of growth of additional land coming online under solar is staggering. You know, that's one of the things that we're looking at as an industry, oddly enough, is are there enough sheep to handle the growth in solar in the next decade? So we're having larger conversations about how do we ensure that there's enough animals and, equally importantly, enough people trained to manage animals to ensure that we can manage this land and vegetation under solar in the most ecologically viable way possible.
How big are the solar farms that you're working with, and how many sheep are you likely to be managing in an individual farm? Is there a rule of thumb?
Not so much. There's a lot of variables that impact it. However, we're looking at sites that are many thousands of acres contiguous, one single site. Even a site that's, say, only 500 acres, we may still have 3,000 sheep on that site. Again, there's a variety of reasons we do that. It is more cost effective to run a larger band of sheep on a site than to build lots of temporary fence to move them around. So we can, particularly most of our properties are, if they're not connected, are still in a relatively small area that we might move them 20 miles up the road. They may be on a larger site for 2 months, and then they may spend a week at a time on a handful of smaller sites and then come back in a planned grazing rotation. Just a small aside on that is that allows not only for full recovery of the plants, but supports the biodiversity so that ground nesting birds have a chance to have their eggs hatch and the young birds become young adults and be able to leave that environment before we come back and graze. It allows plants to set seed and flowers and attract pollinators. There's a variety of reasons why we do that impact. And having sheep continuously graze not only could lead to potential degradation of the land, but certainly would not support whole, healthy, biodiverse environment that is the main reason we were contacted by solar in the first place, is our track record of working with the Savory Institute and being able to verify and validate that we can regenerate land and we can sequester carbon. We can do these things, and it's just really exciting to be able to have a chance to do it at a much larger scale with a higher visibility project.
I want to come on to your relationship with the Savory Institute in just a little while, but before we do that, I'd like to pick up on the welfare element, because I know that there will be people who are listening to this podcast who are perhaps uncomfortable with the idea of livestock being transported in large numbers in trucks between different solar installations every few days. So I just wonder if you could help us out and talk through that transportation element and talk about how you ensure the health and welfare of your flock.
Yeah, absolutely. We believe in having a very transparent operation. It's through education and awareness that people learn and become more comfortable with ideas that perhaps at first blush they may have a reaction to. We're very careful about the genetics we select for a variety of reasons. We work in a hot area that tends to be quite humid, and not all sheep thrive under those conditions. So we've largely settled on hair sheep, in this case, predominantly Dorper and Dorper crossbred sheep that can handle the stress of the heat and the humidity. They also, interestingly enough, by default, are browsers or non-selective grazers, having originated in South Africa as a cross between the Persian fat tail and the Dorset sheep. And these are very docile sheep. It's almost like a milk cow. We work with them all the time. And when we go to gather, we actually have learned that we make sure we do not open the doors on the trucks and trailers until we're ready, because they will simply walk on themselves. It's like calling cows to a new pasture through a gate. They know there's fresh grass on the other side. And so they're like, hey, you know, let us in, take us to somewhere else where there's fresh grass. And it's just really not the stress on the animals that people would maybe think if they didn't have the experience of working with livestock. That being said, we have very vigorous health protocols that we follow. We have put gobs of money and time into researching the mineral supplement that we need. We've got some excellent supplements that we work with manufacturers to ensure that the nutritional needs of the sheep are met, particularly with the variables in forage type and quality, to ensure that gut health is optimal. When you have a ruminant, if you can keep that rumen full and functioning well, that animal can handle a lot, whether it's external stress, internal parasite stress, variations in feed quality and volume. Keeping that animal healthy and digesting well is absolutely critical. And so that's a big area of our focus. And we run all very late model equipment, specifically designed to allow for maximum airflow. At the same time, for winter transport, all the trailers can be boarded up so that there's minimal airflow to ensure that the animals are maintained at a comfortable level. So we take animal welfare very, very seriously. In fact, there is not a livestock producer in the world that has anybody care more about their animals than they do. That is our wealth. That is our financial security, is in those animals. And there is nothing more important to us than ensuring that those animals are as healthy and happy as we can make them. We take care of the sheep take care of us.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because you're talking there about this really synergistic model that you're running, where there is energy being produced, there's food being produced, there's biodiversity being produced because of the way that you're managing the sheep in a regenerative way. You're building soil organic matter, drawing down more carbon at the same time as you've got the renewable electricity that's reducing the carbon intensity on the grid as well. It's really interesting stuff. And Sophie, you know, of course, there are direct welfare benefits for sheep being grazed in solar farms too, aren't there?
Well, yes, absolutely. So in times of bad weather, the solar panels provide shelter from the wind and the rain. And in times of extreme heat, they can provide shade. And I have had anecdotal evidence from farmers that their actual yield of lambs has gone up slightly.
So it's not just the welfare, but the health of the sheep that are being impacted as well. In Britain, we've talked a little bit about different ways of managing the sheep within a solar farm installation. But I'm wondering if you've come across examples of other regenerative farming or other farming systems around solar that don't include sheep.
At almost all the solar farm projects that I work on in the UK, we invite beekeepers to keep beehives on the solar farm or in the on land immediately adjacent to the solar farm. But they like to keep their hives inside the solar farm because the fence provides an element of security. Again, I've had a beekeeper tell me that his honey yield has increased since the pollinating flowers were grown around the solar panels. He also has seen less of the nasty predatory Asian hornet. In other countries, they're experimenting with growing fruit and vegetables on solar farms. As long as the width between the rows of panels is wide enough for a small tractor, which it usually is, there's no reason why you can't grow, for example, soft fruit like raspberries and so on. We're not quite there yet in the UK, but I think that is probably the direction that we'll be going in. And, you know, that goes by the good name of agrivoltaics.
You'd be able to grow arable as well. It would just be a different way of doing it. And there are, you know, plenty of farmers that we've spoken to who are growing lines of trees with arable rides in between them. The same could be true with solar.
Yes, as soon as you said that, I thought of agroforestry. Yes, I don't see why you shouldn't. Yeah, absolutely.
Trent, your impact as a regenerative farmer is monitored. You're certified by the American Grass Fed Association, as well as by Savory Land to Market programmes. What did the people at the Savory Institute think about your approach to regenerative agriculture when you first talked to them? It must have been an original concept for them.
They're a very creative bunch. We've been working with them for many years now and just really impressed with their worldview. They're about doing good everywhere. And while some people may not want to look at a sea of glass, whether we agree with it or not, it is happening and it is going to continue to happen. So how do we make the best of it? How do we add the most value to this essentially inevitable tide of solar production? And there's nothing singular in nature. You know, there are very few examples that say this is a standalone species with no impact against it or on others. That just isn't part of nature. Everything is in wholes. Alan Savory and the Savory Institute are all about understanding wholes, the WHOLES. And holistic management is about considering everything from every angle. It's about the relationships between. And they're being incredibly supportive of our work. In fact, we've worked with other members of the Savory Institute in other countries around the world, giving them the benefit of our experience as they evaluate solar grazing opportunities in their countries and regions. So a tremendous amount of support, and we're able to verify and validate that the land under solar is in fact regenerating.
And when you talk about demonstrating that, Trent, can you just give us an idea of some of the outcomes that you're measuring there?
Yeah, so we use the Ecological Health Index or Ecological Outcome Verification, which is a myriad of data points reduced to an ecological health index, a single number representing the property on a baseline of a year evaluation. And we do long-term studies every 5 years, and we do short-term monitoring every year in between. And that allows us to identify on a range of minus 100 to plus 100, we plug in that ecological health index number. And as long as that number is improving or increasing year over year, it's a positive trend line. Therefore, we can say that the land is regenerating. And land regeneration results in many, many variables. For example, we have seen land under our management go from 1% organic matter to over 4% in less than 6 years. We have seen water retention, water absorption rates increase dramatically. The world is beginning to wake up to the fact that water is more important than oil, and we need to understand how to be stewards of that water to ensure that there's sufficient clean water widely dispersed for all of our needs. And how we manage land directly connects to water availability and quality. And so being a steward of these lands and having the tools provided by the Savory Institute to not only manage the land, but to also be able to pull statistically viable data that allows us to make better decisions, that also verifies and validates that, yes, progress has indeed been made, or in some instances, progress may not have been achieved, but then we have a feedback loop that allows us to say, okay, here's what didn't work, here's what went wrong, or here are the factors outside of our influence that contributed to this situation. How do we pivot? What do we do differently? You know, if in fact, do we need to do anything differently? Or is this an anomaly in a weather pattern that we simply need to power through? So being able to have a model that allows us to evaluate and have have continuous improvement through feedback is phenomenally valuable. And quite frankly, that's why our family business was approached initially by Solar, was as a result of having that experience and that formula in cooperation with the Savory Institute. So there's some forward-thinking people in Solar that are saying, hey, whether we intended it or not at the outset, we are stewards and owners of vast swaths of land. What are we going to do with them? One, it has to be managed, but how can we manage it in a way that has the most desirable results with a moderate cost structure? And by managing land in a way that can be verified as regenerating, it positions the land to potentially participate in ecometric or carbon schemes for additional revenue flows that could possibly one day offset the cost of managing that land. So it's a very genuinely capitalistic approach, while also a very environmentally aware and sensitive approach.
That's really fascinating. And I'm really interested in that statistic that you gave us there of going from 1% organic matter to 4% organic matter in 6 years. There's a lot of argument that's taking place at the moment about the degree to which soil can be grown, soil carbon can be grown. And I just wonder what your own view is, Trent, about the amount of soil that can be accrued, the amount of organic matter. Is it finite or does it just keep going?
You know, it's a good question, and I don't think anybody has a finite answer on that. We know that there is no doubt that we can build healthy soil. We know that if we do not adopt more regenerative practices, we will lose soil and degenerate soils through monoculture cropping and extractive cropping and mining approaches. So really, why set a goal of a finite number? Because who would have believed we could move from 1% to 4% in 6 years of organic matter? So if they said, no, you can only do 1% every 10 years, then we would not have achieved what we achieved. So I'm reluctant to say, here's where the ceiling is. I would say we can demonstrate, we can validate, we can prove without any argument that we can build soil. We can increase the organic matter, which essentially leads to, you know, storing more carbon in the ground. An interesting detail, as we've evaluated this particular property in the last few days that we got this data on, is that we have monitored the land's output production of agricultural product, in this case, livestock. And essentially, for every 1 point of increase in organic matter, we're having a one-fold increase in animal livestock production on the same land base. So when we went from 1% to 4% organic matter, we increased the agricultural output of that same land by approximately 4x as well. Do we think over the next decade that same rate of increase will be maintained? Doubtful. I don't say it's impossible, but I am also, you know, not foolish enough to say that it's a guarantee. But what if we don't achieve that? What if we only achieve 10% of that? That's a freaking home run. I mean, that's amazing. It's a whole win. There's no argument. And so I think people discuss the wrong things. I think they're focused on the wrong metrics. I think that their motivations may be suspect. And so really, we just prefer to focus on the positive outcomes that we can validate within our own enterprises. And we could not be more excited about our ability to steward the land in ways that lead to incredibly positive outcomes as a whole.
Sophie, just finally, one of the issues that we've been coming back to quite a lot in the podcast recently, particularly in the Land Unlocked series that we've been doing with the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission in the run-up to COP26, is the importance of power being given back to people, in having local power to deliver change on the ground and taking it back from some of the big corporate profit centres that exist. So in terms of solar farms, whether it's here or in the USA, there are often owned by people and profit centres that can be quite far removed from the land itself. And I wonder if that's a concern.
Well, not really. First of all, the farmers who host the solar farms are getting a rental income for having solar panels on their land, which allows them to continue to farm in the way that they want to, that is probably best for the planet. But then secondly, many solar farm projects will put money back into the local community through a community benefit fund or through a community ownership scheme, as we discussed earlier. But then eventually, solar farms are assets, just like many other things, and a lot of them end up being owned by pension funds. As you know, there's a big move afoot for pension funds to divest away from investments in fossil fuels, and a solar farm is a really good asset for a pension fund to invest in because it is stable and predictable returns. And so anybody who has a pension is benefiting indirectly from that solar farm. And then I suppose the final issue that we haven't actually covered is that solar energy is currently one of the cheapest new forms of energy generation in the world, on a par with onshore wind. In some places it's cheaper. And so the benefits of solar are being felt in everybody's pockets because it's helping to bring down energy costs for everybody.
So that's really interesting. You're saying that although that profit center might be elsewhere, because you've got the farmer, because you've got that local land, because you're engaging with the community in the design of that solar farm, and because there might be a community fund associated with it, quite apart from the fact that then the investments are going into people's pension funds, that there is a sort of a cycle that brings it back to local people in the end anyway. That's fantastic. That's been so interesting, but that's all we've got time for. I'd like to thank my guests, Trent Hendricks and Sophie Fernley Whittingstall. You can find Sophie on Twitter using the handle at SFWComs, and Cabrieho Ranch can be found on Instagram. If you've enjoyed listening, please come back and listen to more. Tell your friends, like us, review us, and share our links. Farmgate is a partnership project for Farmwell and FAI Farms. We're funded by Sankalpa, and you can join the conversation on Twitter by searching for Farmgate Podcast. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.